you do MMA, right?
Mm-hmm.
I saw an episode of your show where you, Liddell, was it?
Chuck Liddell.
And you went at his gloves and you punched into his fist and stuff.
Yeah, he wasn't really good at holding the mitts. Oh, yeah. I usually do it with my guy.
Yeah.
And he's really good at holding them. Although I'm getting him punching so hard, he doesn't even want to do it anymore. So it's fine. I've really gotten into it. So I hit the heavy bag. I hit the mitts. I do a lot of core.
Happy Easter and vernal equinox. You're listening to NPR. I'm your host, Will Meniker, and this is All Things Considered. Today, I'll be considering things with my usual co-host, Matt Chrisman.
Sup, bros?
And Felix Biederman.
Easter. That day of the kid's mama.
If all has gone according to plan, the sonorous tones you just heard before my own voice were none other than those of Fox News' Sean Hannity. And if you didn't just hear that, then it's the fault of the other gentleman who's joining us today, Brendan James. Say hi.
Hello, and thank you. Thank you guys for having me on. I'm honored to be the first guest. I hope I'm not wrong that I am the first guest of this storied segment. It's a great honor.
You, indeed, you are the first guest, but if you didn't just hear Sean Hannity right now before I started talking, then enjoy Brendan James' last appearance on this show.
Yeah.
Just a slight correction, though. You know, we don't really have guests on this show. You know, we only have co-hosts and people we've rolled into the Chapo Gang, Mafia, Savage Squad.
As Vin Diesel said in Fast and the Furious 7, we don't have guests. We have family.
That's beautiful.
Exactly.
I mean, I do have to clarify that we had recorded in our second episode, we had recorded an interview with Frank Luntz, but spent the whole time talking about his perfect Saturday, and it was too depressing for human ears. So we had to delete the tape and scrap all of our laptops and buy new ones. It cost a lot of money.
Okay. Yeah, we are sort of a horizontalist, sort of non-hierarchical, leaderless organization that comes together, united by their belief in the cult of personality based around myself, that I'm the one unique visionary revolutionary leader. I am like the Bob Avakian of podcasts. There are absolutely no rules or hierarchy here, provided you do exactly what I say.
Okay.
Wait a minute. This is I always assumed I was Bob Avakian. We got a problem down here.
So yeah, it's episode 3. Happy Easter to everybody. Episode 3 of the Chapo Trap House. Since episode 2, we've had some amazing feedback from all the fans. People are loving it, and I just want to give a quick shout out to Tree of Woe on Twitter, created an intro for the Woke Zoo Crew that was very funny, and hopefully we can use that sometime. On episode 1, I remember I said someone needs to make a Photoshop of us, the Deadpool Joker Heisenberg mashup, and Actual Liam on Twitter, at Actual Liam, did just that for me.
If you guys want that, we can send it to you, but only through encryption. It's too long to send over the regular data plan.
It's only on the dark web.
Yeah.
And one more Agatha Soze meme got in touch with us to say, thanks so much for the podcast. I learned so much from you.
That's terrifying. That's fucking terrifying.
This is a horrifying thought, but hopefully we'll learn you some more shit this week. But like I said, we had a lot of really great feedback, a lot of really great comments. People are just hopping in the mentions to say how much they like it. So thanks to all you guys who ride with the Trap House. We love you. Keep it coming. But just a quick note, a few people did get at me to say something along the lines of, oh, I just listened to episode 2. Like, it was really good, even better than the first one. Or, you guys are really getting the hang of it now. It's awesome. I just want to say to those people, first of all, you're blocked. Second of all, if that's the attitude you have, we do not want you as fans. Do not listen to us. Like, you know, you're dead to us.
If you can't handle us at our episode 1, you don't deserve us at our episode 2.
If you thought episode 1 was anything less than stellar, then, like I said, blocked, reported, I am contacting my attorney. I have screenshots of all of this.
We only want our family.
Yeah. Ride or die, homies, only.
Exactly. Blood in, blood out in the Chapo gang. That's what we say.
Paid in full.
Belly.
Oh, that was a great movie. We should do an episode about Belly. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I feel it's probably worth a second viewing. Anyway, I've been watching a lot of Vikings this week on the History Channel. That's what I've been up to. It's like Game of Thrones, but real. It's better because it's real.
Right.
So, to begin today's episode, a few things of note in the election. Basically, a little birdie, landed on Bernie's podium, and he ended up winning Alaska, Hawaii, and Washington State.
Sure it did, you gullible dumbasses. Sure, a bird just happened to land on Bernie's podium. Sure it did.
Didn't
you believe that if you want?
Didn't people get legitimately mad at the bird online?
They were mad at the bird, or they claimed that it was a trained bird. That's what I saw.
It was like the dog on Frasier. Like it was a show business bird.
They had one of those seed bells under. You couldn't see it. It was right under the podium, though.
Bernie rubbed like bird feet on the back of his neck and then went on stage.
He totally did.
Yeah.
I saw people saying, "You idiot, sheeple! Of course it was a trained bird." And then I saw someone who wasn't angry at the bird, but they were angry on the bird's behalf because, well, they were like, "Well, surely it was terrified by all the hooting and clapping."
Way to appropriate that bird's experience for your Bernie bro talking points.
Well, yeah, the Bernie bros, they love gaslight birds. I saw a Bernie bro. He found a POC cockatiel, and he told it to stop talking. Just like Bernie, he waved his finger in its face and said, "Hey, I'm talking."
I think my favorite thing, though, was the memesters online, the Hillary memesters who tried to, like, jujitsu it and be like, "Oh, yeah, well, big deal, stupid bird." And so one of them was they photoshopped Hillary's face on Daenerys Targaryen from Game of Thrones with the dragon on her shoulder. And they go, a sparrow? Oh, a sparrow? That's cute.
Yeah, got him.
And I was like, oh, thank you. I hadn't wanted to die before that, but now I do. Thank you very much.
Hillary is an inbred monarch.
Claiming the throne of an absolute monarchy using weapons of mass destruction. That's a model for Hillary to follow.
Someone photoshopped Bernie's face onto Jafar from Aladdin when he had the Gilbert Gottfried parrot sitting on his shoulder.
God. That's actually... I might laugh at that if I saw that.
Sounds pretty whimsical and silly.
Yeah, Dow,
that's too good for them to
Peter,
do. They
Peter
wouldn't
Dow,
do that.
Peter Dow, David Brock, please hire me as a meme smith. I will weaponize your memes by blood and cross. And the other news of note this week was, of course, the Ted Cruz sex scandal.
I just vomited again.
Ted has a harem of women, according to the National Inquirer.
I just want to say right now, for everyone listening, that I stand four square with Ted Cruz against the smears of the National Inquirer and Donald Trump, because I would much sooner believe that he had sex with a pulsating sack of spider eggs than with a human woman.
I think Ted Cruz is a player. I think, like, he gets all the boys, like, fucking Jeff Rowe, his campaign manager, all the boys run the Acela derp on that hoe.
He loves to get a woman all riled up by reading from a list of logical fallacies.
Yo, I gave that bitch the ipso propter hoc.
And every time he comes, he says, "You proved my point."
Ew. Is this going to affect the election? How does this game out for Ted Cruz?
Oh, hold on. We have Carl Digler coming in.
We've got Dig on the line. We have Dig on the line.
Hello, boys. The biggest thing for Ted Cruz is that outside of his highly spectrum base of supporters, very few people see him as human. And also, if half these allegations turn out to be true, he is in the game for a divorce. And from personal experience, a divorce is a personal renaissance where the ashes of family court produce a phoenix of a divorced man.
Yeah, I would love to see Ted Cruz on, like, Our Time, the older person's dating app website. And he's got, you know, under favorites, under, like, you know, likes and dislike, he likes rational dialogue and debates and pointing out logical fallacies and Outback Steakhouse.
What do you think Ted Cruz's balls sound like slapping up against him?
Oh.
If you just stick your fist into a jar of herring, just like open and close your fist.
I think it sounds more like the chitinous clatter of like the wings of a beetle or something.
Yeah, it's very like Book of Revelation. It says.
Yeah, it's an unholy sound.
Yeah.
Like if anybody is listening, has listened to, has ever read any of the Dark Tower books by Stephen King. The way that he describes the low men, these like they're basically like these bird creatures, bird or insect creatures in human skins, who walk around amongst us wearing long coats. It'll bring you to mind Ted Cruz.
Oh, I was sort of thinking that movie Mimic.
Yes, exactly.
About the giant cockroaches that look like people.
That's it. You got him. He's a mimic.
Okay. Well, yeah, Ted Cruz has done a very good job of mimicking a human being so far on the campaign.
Good enough, I guess.
A good enough one, but it can't last.
No. Well, that's the thing. It's like, he was fucked before this. I don't think it's going to matter. I mean, it's either, I don't know, maybe if, I don't think it's going to matter because he's going to, at this point, he just has to cross his fingers that Trump doesn't get to 1-2-3-7 delegates, you know? Because if he's like, if they do like start throwing spanners in the works, if the RNC starts doing shenanigans and rat fucking at the convention, they're not going to do it on behalf of him, you know. So he's not going to be like a second ballot winner. So I don't think he has a chance. Regardless, he's going to have to just molt for a while.
I think it's I don't know. It's safe to say that I don't know. I'm not embarrassed to admit that when I first heard this story, basically my only thought was, "God damn, senators must get a lot of pussy." I mean, like that must be what the job is all about, right?
Well, Marco Rubio allegedly—I don't want a second lawsuit—allegedly has like a litter of bastard children. Man,
yeah, yes, I've heard that.
Hates condoms. Marco Rubio's like good looking for Senate Sanders. He's kind of young. He's not fully bald yet. He's a cute little guy. He's just probably tearing it up, Marco.
Well, I mean, hell. I mean, Lyndon Johnson was a legendary cocksman, and he might be the ugliest man in the history of American politics. So if you get high enough in the echelons of power, you're going to get some strange.
Master of the Senate.
Martin Van Buren, actually, they built the Eiffel Tower based on Martin Van Buren's exploits. The sexual position was invented before the building.
He was an innovator.
Yeah.
The old Fox of Kinderhook, they called him.
Yeah.
So that was that's the week's news, folks. But we would be remiss if we didn't now transition to our co-host, Brendan, who, as long as we have on now, we have to take advantage of him.
Co-family,
remember. Yeah, now that he's in the family, we have to take advantage of him, because that's what you do with family members. Brendan, can you give us some money?
Oh,
do you have $1,000?
Yeah, we would like some money, please.
I thought this was
Venmo.
Bitcoin only, sorry. Yeah.
You don't know if you can do it today. Please help keep my family together. Maybe don't get Grubhub today. My daughter has her heart set on this apartment.
Yeah.
Fuck shit, you're on.
I have a part-time job making memes online for donations, and we really want to stay in our 7,000 square foot Central Park West apartment.
And when I give you guys this money, you're not going to just disappear and suddenly not be on the internet or do the show anymore, right? Like, you're definitely going to use it for what you said it was going to be for, right?
There's a more than good chance that we will use the money you give us for what we said we would. No, Brendan, we wanted to have you on because you are, by trade, a reporter. You cover the media and politics for a living, basically. You're at the International Business Times, IBT, which I just to be sure, you're not with the Independent Journal Review.
Yeah, no, I'm not. We're sort of sister publications, but I'm.
Have you interviewed the Wild Man?
I've never met him in person, but I think I was on a call one time. He was on the call.
Does his voice smell like gun smoke and cinnamon?
Yeah, it was sort of nutmeg and gunpowder. Yeah.
Whenever I see IBT, I always confuse it with IJR and Investors Business Daily.
They're all fine publications.
Brendan, you write for the one that isn't just like a sluice of raw sewage, right?
I would like to say yes. In case my employer hears this, I'm going to stick up for them and say that we do not get most of our traffic from filming Ted Cruz doing impersonations of Homer Simpson and then getting it viral. That's not our actual business model.
Do you have any affiliation with ICP, the Insane Clown Posse?
We share content. We have an ad network we both are in, but it's not anything more than that.
Are you officially a member of the family?
This family is the only family I consider myself a member of.
Good answer. Well done. You're in. Yeah,
thank you. Yeah, no. I actually did a piece on IJR one time, and they've never ever responded to any of my emails since, and it's a bummer because
the best part about IJR is how independent they are, right?
Well, that's the thing.
Wasn't that the point of your piece? Well, since you're not, since your business model is based on something else at IBT, yeah. I would say one of the business model is sizzling takes, but also great profile writing by Brendan James. Thanks. And I'm referring to an article that you wrote for them back in December that was a profile of Sean Hannity of Fox News.
That's right. It also was in the January issue of Newsweek in print.
When I was in my doctor's office, I saw that. But yeah, like we wanted to have you on because I remember reading this piece when it came out, and it was really funny and good. It was a great portrait of Sean Hannity, which is someone who I think, you know, if you're like me, you've wondered from time to time what it would be like to sit across from a table with him. And Brendan, you did just that. So
yes.
Why don't you tell me, like, how did this piece sort of come together, and what was it like?
I was genuinely curious about Hannity because, before I worked at IBT, I worked at Talking Points Memo, which if any of your listeners are familiar with it, there's a lot of media reporting that goes on at TPM and a lot of Fox News watching. So I had certainly been tuned into Hannity for a long time, and this election seemed kind of precarious for him because he is the GOP's man inside Fox News. I'm sure a lot of people think of Fox as an arm of the GOP to begin with, but there are streaks of independence at Fox, and you know O'Reilly tends to kind of gleefully shirk certain party. Party obligations. He says he believes in climate change.
Shirking obligations, be they ideological or court appointed, seems to be part of Bill O'Reilly's brand.
It's part of it. He's got a swagger and all of the above. And then you have obviously for a while Glenn Beck was there. He was actually quite the like Tea Party sectarian. He railed against the establishment GOP. But Hannity, he's never really declared himself like politically beyond just being very, very friendly to the Republicans. And obviously he was on top of Jeremiah Wright, like white on rice. He is a very, very effective propagandist against the Democratic Party. But we're in an election season now where the GOP, and indeed we've been in a political climate for a while now where the GOP is tearing itself apart, and Donald Trump has only magnified that gulf. So I wanted to check in with Hannity because it seems like this would be causing him a lot of problems. And so Fox miraculously let me have lunch with him. And part of the clips that you'll hear at the end and that you heard in the beginning of the show is just a little taste of us at this steakhouse across from News Corp. But it was a wild ride, I have to say. We talked about a lot of stuff.
Like, when I imagine Sean Hannity, like, you know, he must have, he obviously knows you're part of the liberal media, and he pointed that out to the waiter at one point.
He did.
Did he call you a shit lib at any point?
No, he did. He got kind of testy, but would retreat. I gotta say, just before we go on, like, I think the content of my piece makes it clear, you know, like what truly what the experience is like to be with Hannity and what he really is like. And it's a critical.
We will link to the piece in the description, so everyone will be able to read this. But
wonderful.
I like it.
Or if they wanna find the copy of Newsweek floating around from a couple months ago.
Yeah, make an appointment with your dentist.
So no, but I will say he is like he has a certain kind of boyish charm that I don't think you would get at all from Bill O'Reilly. Like I've heard people who have worked at Fox and Bill O'Reilly, you'll get in the elevator with him and you'll like try to shake his hand and it will be a wet fish, you know, just like a very disinterested and possibly no eye contact. But Hannity was very engaging and he would make fun of me and he would call me the liberal media, but it was kind of, I don't get the sense he really cared or was worried I was going to like, you know, bust him on anything.
Sort of what he strikes me as, and I think it comes across really well in the piece, is like a kind of guy who, like being gregarious with people is kind of his way of being alpha to them, and he has like a pathological need to like be the alpha dog in every room. So like, right away, he tells you you're at a steakhouse for lunch, and he tells you right away his lunch is going to be weird. Because he's just having scrambled eggs, onions, and a side of bacon. Yeah. But he made a point of saying, usually I would have a steak.
That's correct.
And when I read that, I thought he was like, he literally is the come to life, the Matt, your joke about the guy who eats steak every day.
I eat steak every day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner to own libs. I haven't shit in 3 years. I have stage 5 colon cancer. But you know what? I live my life on my terms, and I'm happy about it.
Meet the Argentinian gauchos who die at 45.
And then he immediately starts telling you about he's like, I'm on a very strict regimen right now because I'm working out so much, he said. The conversation rapidly moved to his workout routine, specifically his passion for mixed martial arts. I hit the peavy bag, I hit the mitts, I do a lot of core. And it's like, did you just meet him and, like, this is the first thing he's telling you about?
That was roughly, like, 12 seconds.
Like, 12 seconds after meeting this guy. This is he's telling you about hitting the heavy bag and how, about how...
That's a sign of deep security.
I might order a little weird because my throat is dry from fucking my wife.
I have to know, did he at any point at... confirm or deny that he has Alan Combs in his basement?
Well, I asked about Alan Combs, and I can say this because it was on the record. I asked about Alan Combs. I was like, and it was near the end of the interview, and that was the one time when they really, because there was a Fox PR person flanking him the whole lunch. And that was the one time they both got really offended. They were like, what are you, that's old. This is so old news. Like, why are we talking about Alan Combs? And I mean, it's possible he is sick of talking about Alan Combs, but I couldn't, like, not ask. Like, do you guys know each other at all, like, offset, or, like, what's the deal? And I think he said that Alan Combs is literally his best friend. So that's their relationship.
That is such a mutual own. Oh, my God. That's the best double-edged own I've ever heard.
When he said that to Brendan, Ron Fournier woke up with a hard on.
It's possible. There's hope for this country.
I was actually very surprised how they just wanted to move right along from that. But we actually kind of addressed that in the interview. I was trying to say, you know, you're unapologetically conservative. I mean, does that work for you off air? And he proceeded to you know, kind of list a bunch of liberals at Fox that he's tight with, which, you know, didn't really qualify for me. And then he said, and I just didn't make it into the piece. The piece was really long, and there's a lot of more stuff I could have put in. But he said, you know, the other day, I mean, do I get along with liberals? I just saw Joe Lieberman the other day, gave him a big hug. And I called him on it, and I was like, yeah, I mean, I don't know if Joe Lieberman is everyone's idea of like a raging lib. He's switched parties, first of all, and he was just like, wow, yeah, I guess. But, you know, anyway, and he just kind of like didn't really acknowledge it and kept talking about how much he loved Joe Lieberman. So that was the extent of his bipartisanship that I sort of got a flavor of.
Now, he mentioned his MMA workout. He's hitting the heavy bag. He's doing a lot of core.
Yeah.
In the article, you embed a YouTube clip from his show where they go to Hannity's home gym and he works out with Chuck Liddell.
Now, Felix, Chuck the Iceman.
Chuck the Iceman Liddell. Now, Felix is our resident MMA fighting expert. He's our warrior. He's the Chapo warrior. Felix, did you watch the video? And what, like, how do you break down Hannity's fight game?
Oh, I've watched it many times. There are a lot of things. I have a lot of favorite parts about this video. One is that he's being trained by Chuck Liddell. Now, if you guys ever saw a Chuck Liddell fight, he was, like, in his prime, he was a fucking awesome fighter. But his fighting style was basically that he was really hard to take down because he was a very good wrestler in college, and he wanted to stand and trade punches with you. And he threw these really looping, weird punches that he threw his entire body into, and he could knock almost anybody out with them. But his entire fighting style depended on being, like, a drunk redneck who doesn't get knocked out that easily. It's not like the type of thing you would teach somebody. It's that you would, if you were teaching to somebody, the first thing you ask them is, okay, do you have an abnormally thick skull, or are you not afraid of anything?
And I think Sean Hannity does, though.
It's like when Homer Simpson became a boxer, where his secret weapon was just that he had an extra layer of head fat, so they couldn't knock him down.
He's got a big old dough head, so he might be able to pull it off. And you see him, there's a point in this video where Hannity is doing, this is what he's doing, the MMA, like, pad hitting stuff, and he does, like, Chuck, who's just, like, fucking punch drunk and everything else drunk at this point, he's like, hey, there are two types of, he's showing me a boxer's favorite left hook, there are 10 left hooks in boxing. And he throws the correct one, and then he just throws, like, an insane looping one that would get you hit by anyone. It's, like, deep boxing. And Hannity has begun training this way, just throwing, like, really looping, weird punches that he's, like...
Like a haymaker, like a whole wind-up, like...
And the thing is, he's, like, old. And he's not going to be able to land that on anyone but an old person. But my second favorite part is that Hannity's actual trainer, like, because he's not flying in Chuck Liddell all the time, he doesn't have that much money, is... He's like a fucking crank. He's teaching Hannity how to, like, clap people on the ears and, like, do these pre-rehearsed moves that are the hallmark of self-defense of Krav Maga.
At one point in the video, he's teaching him how to fight with sticks, right?
Yes.
Like, he has two fighting sticks, and he's like, well, you get a good rhythm, and he's hitting a heavy bag with sticks.
Yes.
On some martial arts shit. I mean, I don't know what you call that, but he's...
Shout out to Johnny.
Oh, you know, it was like what Stallone does in the beginning of Rambo 3 when he's street fighting in Thailand.
What that is called, what he's doing with the sticks, is called Kali. It's a Filipino martial art. Shout out to Johnny is good on Twitter, who the other day, Johnny is good as Filipino, and he said, he observed, why is it only dumpy white guys who like Kali? And there you go in the video.
Well, that you can see it, and I'm actually looking at the YouTube. I haven't played it. I'm just looking at the screen of a clip, and Sean Hannity in this video is wearing a workout hoodie with Chris Kyle written on the front of it.
That's right. I actually forgot to include that. He's got, I think that his ball cap that he's got on that he eventually turns backwards.
Oh, he's got it on backwards than what I'm looking at now.
But I think it's an FBI hat. Also, that he's wearing an FBI cap and then a Chris Kyle sweatshirt. But I also would want to point out, I'm sure this didn't escape Felix's attention, that during the interview I asked him about, I said, you know, you train with Liddell. Hannity says, yeah, he wasn't really good at holding the mitts. I usually do it with my guy. My guy, he's really good at holding them, but I'm punching so hard now, he doesn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
And like, again, Brendan, and again, like, he told you this within like 30 seconds of meeting him.
Now, just in his
defense,
or was
this a little bit longer?
It wasn't all in 30 seconds. The MMA conversation happened over a couple minutes because I also certainly came to hear him talk about that. Like, there was no way I wasn't going to ask him about that video or his gym. So it wasn't that he totally like I was trying to talk about the election. He kept interrupting me to go on about his core.
Well, that's the thing that comes across in the article is that Hannity is a big fan of physical culture, but also he has a
strength through joy.
He also has a real need to kind of like impress people and impress everyone around him. And I'm just going to read one other clip from your piece where you say a makeup artist spent at least 2 minutes explaining how Hannity is the nicest man in show business. I swear that wasn't a plant, a Fox News PR person said. Yeah, Hannity's a hoot, said Lou, one of the cameramen during a taping of the show. One time he challenged me to do 100 push-ups. The worker turned to Hannity, who was wiring up his mic to do a segment, his blue jeans visible under the desk. How many was it, 100? The mere mention of this incident brought Hannity to the middle of the set, where he challenged the crewman to a brief rematch. They both dropped to the floor and started pumping out push-ups. Hannity grunted and eventually started clapping his hands in between push-ups, Travis Bickle style. So, like, he wanted to make a display. He wanted, he's like, I'll challenge you to do 100 push-ups right now. And then just starts doing them.
Well, so, of course, whenever you're doing, and I'm fairly green in this business, but, you know, whenever you're doing a profile, you can assume, especially if someone in show business, you can assume that they're trying to maybe gin up some of their personality and their rapport with their staff in front of you, the journalist. But I really do get the feeling, like, unless they were all in on it, that, like, he really does do that daily. And I have to say, I actually don't think that person was a plant. I don't think that his crew were all kissing his ass. I think he is very likable, like, in person, and his persona in person is a lot different than his persona on air. I'm not saying it erases anything that he says day by day or the avenues he goes down.
But that is markedly different from everything I've read, as you've mentioned. The people who work with Bill O'Reilly, like, really hate him.
Right.
And like that he's not a nice person to be around at all.
That's true. Sean Hannity may think that Black Lives Matter is literally a branch of the Ku Klux Klan.
A branch of the Ku Klux Klan, but their moral equivalent.
Yeah, he may think that they're moral equivalents, but in person, you could possibly have, like, a fun time with him out at a bar. Like, he'll do push-ups, he'll challenge you to an MMA fight.
I would go out with him to a bar to see if I could balance my drink perfectly on his fucking dinner table head. His fucking aircraft carrier head. Him and Alan West, if you put them next to each other, you could put, like, a level there, and the bead would be right in the middle.
You know that, like, the travel custom of drinking out of your enemy's skulls? With Andy or Alan West, it would be like a novelty thing that you get at the Super Bowl. Like a thing of beer, like some Mardi Gras shit.
And it would be like, You would never tip over. It would be one of those, like, you could drive in your car with it because the base is so flat it would never tip over.
They're like the blockheads from Gumby.
Yes.
All right, now,
but I'm sure we have one Hannity thing that I know Will really wants to get to, and we will. But before we get to that one part, I was pretty pleased to find by the end of the piece that, like, my thesis kind of bore out. Like, Hannity, I pressed him, you know, trying to say, like, so, you know, if it comes down to Rubio or Cruz, or if it comes down to Cruz or Trump, like, who are you for? And he wouldn't say. He kept saying I was trying to trick him. I eventually, you know, tried to get him to just define even some positions he had. And, of course, you know, it's like immigration and, you know, have a strong border, like boilerplate stuff, but he refused to say a critical thing about any candidate, He said Marco Rubio will be president someday, maybe not this year, but someday. He said Ted Cruz completely schooled the media at that CNBC debate. John Kasich, Bobby Jindal, and Scott Walker have all done, quote, an outstanding job. Jeb Bush, he didn't say this in the lunch, but he said it later in his show that he's just underperforming, but that's really as harsh as he got.
Nothing, yeah.
Yeah, and then Rick Perry, he said, had a great record and was laughed out of the 2008 race because of a silly flub. And then, of course, Trump, he is an open friend of, and Glenn Beck recently wrote that Sean Hannity, when they bumped into each other at CPAC, Sean Hannity was trying to convert him to Trumpism. And I guess what's interesting now is that this is a couple months on now from this profile, and Hannity has declared, I mean, in all but name, he has declared himself a Trump surrogate. He did a rally, or he did an interview right before a Trump rally in the same building where it was kind of like a warm-up act for a Trump rally. It was like a truly bizarre, even for Hannity, like stretching the limits of non-objectivity. So since this piece, he seems to have finally been able to, like, he feels safe enough to call himself, for Trump.
Well, he's been liberated, and I guess the other sort of, like, through line to your piece is how everything at Fox has shaken out due to the rise of Megyn Kelly.
Yeah.
And her taking that big sort of, like, nightly spot, and Hannity getting what? He got pushed back, right? To, like,
he
10?
Got pushed back. I had big fights with Fox over this about the word bumped. They didn't like the word bumped being used. Like, they, you know, it was like, and when I asked him about it, you know, he went from the 9 o'clock slot to the 10 o'clock slot. He had been live at 9 forever. O'Reilly has always been at 8, and he's kept his throne at 8. And he gets by far the biggest ratings of anyone at Fox and indeed
O'Reilly
does. Cable News. Yeah, O'Reilly does.
Okay.
Kelly's not so far behind, but Hannity has really sunk because his ratings were already starting to dip a bit, but now that he's a 10, he was bumped to a less.
Well, I mean, all of those viewers are asleep by then.
That's
I mean,
wrong.
Literally everyone who watches Fox News is asleep. All of his viewers are.
That's not wrong. But when I brought it up to him, he repeatedly said that being bumped was the best thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah, Brendan, that was great. We're like, you say, so like, what's it like being a 10 now? And he's like, best thing that's ever happened to me. Best thing that's ever happened to me.
It's really like the movement of I'm not mad.
Yeah.
He was not mad. But when I kind of pressed him on it, you know, he got annoyed. And he just said, look, I'm young, I'm healthy, I'm not thinking about the future, you know. And then of course it came back to, like, I'm thinking about my country and saving my kids and my grandkids, and because right now the country's going down the shitter, is what he said. So he seemed a little irked that I kept asking, you know, like, you know, what comes next now that you're sort of receding.
You were trying to trick him, Brendan. Honestly,
I know,
but he wasn't going to have it because he literally said, "It's great, I get to spend more time with my family."
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Every dipshit whoever fucking ate it on the campaign trail by, like, having pictures taken with his dick and an intern says that.
Now there's as Brendan alluded to, there's one final element of your piece that I think was by far the best part that I think truly reveals Hannity's character, and I love this bit. In it, he tells you, I'm just going to quote from you right now. He says, Hannity confided that sometimes when he's traveling the country or bored during book signings, he will put, quote, cute couples on the spot and pressure the man into proposing to his girlfriend. He said Ted Cruz once watched him do it. Okay, that line right there is way creepier.
Oh, my God. His neck grew 3 sizes while he watched that.
Imagine that, those fucking Russian Nesingal eyes looking at
him. Just looking at that, looking at some unsuspecting couple with Hannity going, and this is, I'm now quoting you, quoting him again. I'm like, how long you been dating? Okay, why haven't you asked her? And I put him under the gun. Then I say, why don't you do it now? Hannity began to gesture to an imaginary crowd. Don't you think you should do it now? And the crowd gets into it, he said breathlessly. I have a success rate of about 90%.
Fuck her right in the pussy! Do it! Fuck her right in the pussy! And then they do it.
This is what I mean about how his gregariousness is, like, kind of a mask for his sadism. Because, like, he's telling you this like a Charlie
Manson. That's usually the case. It's like George W. Bush.
It's like he's telling you this like that it's a charming anecdote about what he does for fun when he's bored, but it's literally like he's just torturing these people for his own amusement.
That would be a nightmare for anyone.
He's the human version of like the guy who proposed, like the jumbo screen when the guy proposes to his girlfriend at a sporting event. And like 19,000 people are all watching as she has to like decide on the spot of whether she's going to spend the rest of her night, rest of her life with like a guy in a sports jersey.
I could tell that like when he was telling this, you know, I'm assuming this PR person that was with us like had heard this story before.
I heard it 10,000 times.
She was into it and laughing, and he was kind of smiling. But I don't know what face I was making exactly, but I think I could read from their faces that I looked – I was not on the same page as them.
You probably looked like an owl.
Yeah.
But it's just like it's so weird. This is like the modern version of like the rite of prima nocture, like in Braveheart or something. Like if so,
yeah, he demands that they do it.
He says he has a success rate of 90%, but if your girlfriend says yes, because Hannity made her, like he gets first crack at that. Hannity will have to take his due.
Yeah, they like 6 months later, they're at the wedding and they're at the reception having fun, and then Hannity shows up. And he's like, "You knew what this was."
Well, you knew what this was.
And then she has to like just sadly follow him out of the room and up to the Holiday Inn and Suites.
I think Will the other night you said it was he's like the Godfather where it's like I'll do you this favor but you owe me, and then like. All these young men are like conscripted into the Hannity army that he betroths, and then they have to do him like one life or death favor before they die.
He's yeah, exactly. You got to catch a body for Hannity if he hooked you up with your wife.
What it usually boils down to is he calls them up and he says they have to come to his house and choke him while he jerks off and watches the George Bush Mission Accomplished speech.
Oh, no, so like. Like in The Godfather, you know, Vito's like, one day a day will come when I ask you a favor. Like Hannity does that, but it's in his Hannity voice where he's like, I'll tell you what, I think America is the greatest country that God has ever blessed, and we are blessed to live here, and you will be blessed to do me this favor. God bless America. Well, and then he just hands you a 22 with, like, the serial number filed off.
Yeah, well, so just to like come full circle, that the reason this even came up, which is still a little unclear to me, but I think the reason that this like penchant he has came up is because I asked him about his dating site, which is now defunct, unfortunately.
This is true. Sean Hannity had his own dating site called Hannadate,
and he said many people got married. He says, I don't know the whole number, but a lot. It went for a while, but I had to stop it because it became a legal issue. And I tried to get him to explain what the legal issue was, but it sounded like he was saying that his lawyers advised him that if people broke up, they could blame it on him. Like he was baked into the marriage somehow, liability.
Well, I think we've established his liability. He's literally in people's marriages.
He's not worried about being sued for that, which... Like, directly.
I mean, obviously, he's completely full of shit. I mean, women have been literally murdered because of Craigslist dates and stuff like that, and nobody's suing. So the idea that he would have any kind of liability is ridiculous.
Hannity should be more afraid of his liabilities with the website Hambla. Love Association. Very legal.
Hambla. Oh, well, God.
But there's actually, so you wonder who are these people who went on Hannity, and there is luckily a record, at least of one guy.
Okay, now, yeah, I found this researching Hannadate, but this was a comment left on this forum, and the headline to the, like, it's on one of these threads, and the headline is, I have met 5 women from Hannadate now. Quote, my experience. Okay, I'm gonna read this guy's record of his Hannadates now. First woman, colon, fairly ugly, 2 kids, complete slut. I fucked her on the first date. She went totally insane and wanted to move in with me immediately and take her kids places.
Motherfucking, I ain't going to Chuck E. Cheese.
She was up to her neck in debt, kept calling me for weeks asking me to move in with her with this and that, was crying into my voicemail at one point saying she was broke and was going to have to live on the streets if she didn't get $50,000 by next month, sent PIs looking for me. Okay, she's broke, but hiring PIs to look into this guy. Had to get a restraining order. Learned a lesson with her. Don't fuck them on the first date. They think they own you at that point. Took me 6 months to shake her.
God.
The second ones are quicker. Okay, second. Fat, stupid, and boring as hell. Never called again. She emailed me 10,000 times a day. Obsessed with collecting these little dumb dolls.
It's actually they're a subsidiary of Precious Moments, but they're great moments from World War II atrocities. There's like Baba Yara and things like that.
Third, still married, trying to fuck around. Said her husband didn't bring home enough of the bacon, if you know what I mean.
Obvious. That's Kurt Schlichter's hot wife, I guarantee you.
Oh, yeah.
Obvious gold digger. Demanded we go to a very expensive restaurant for dinner, ordered over $100 worth of food and drinks just for herself. Okay. Fourth, three kids from two different husbands. One was either black or Mexican, not sure. Obviously on drugs. Bitched about Obama the entire date. Miserable. Got completely wasted. Wanted to fuck. I left her in a lump at the door.
Wait a minute. I thought bitching was about Obama was these people's foreplay.
I don't get it.
I thought they talk about Obama phones in order to get wet. I thought that was the whole deal. That's why you go on Hannity.
That's hack, though. That's like, for like conservative dating, that's like asking, what's your sign? Like, the real shit is being like, I'm already threatening Eric Cantor's kids. John Boehner's brakes. I don't care that he's not in Congress anymore. Like, you want to get all up in them guts?
Like, okay. One more. This is the fifth Hannah date. Looked awesome in her picture. Looked like a fat, disheveled retard in real life.
Wow.
Completely lost about her weight.
That's also problematic. I'm going to just put it out there. That's pretty problematic language.
Also a gold digger. Lied about her income. She works as a waitress. She told me she owned a marketing business.
Yeah, she's marketing Denny's Grand Slams. What?
And then after that one, he just says, I decided no more Hannah date. The women there are all desperate spinsters.
Who the fuck does he think is watching Fox News at 9 o'clock at night? People who have a lot going on socially?
I wanna join Hannah Date. I wanna make a profile on the restarted Hannah Date where I list my age preference for women as 18 to 24.
Well, I can say this is that when I brought this up, I asked him, in the age of Tinder and all these new dating apps, because Hannah Date bit the dust in like,
yeah, it's a while
like 2000, ago. Yeah, I think like 2007 or something. And I'm like, you know, you could bring it back. You could make an app. And he said, I actually love the idea. So I don't know if that's a confirmed commitment, but we could see it born again.
The problem with the new app-based Hannah Date is that you can only swipe right.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I'm sorry. I should go to jail for that.
Oh, this has been Matt Crisman, a.k.a. Tweet God, everybody.
Fuck you. Only Tweet of God can judge me.
Oh, man. Okay, so now I want to make the transition now from a figure in the right-wing media, Sean Hannity, who is, like, as we've established, like the ultimate meathead, right? Like, I mean, he's like just a Long Island jock. He trains with Chuck Liddell and makes people get married in front of him for his own amusement.
The guy forged his entire political worldview when he was holding a nerd's head in a toilet in 10th grade. It's like, this is it. This is the world.
So, like, that's one end of the right-wing media. And I want to go around to, like, basically his polar opposite. In a man just known only as Ross Douthat, or as I call him, Boss Douthat. Boss.
Awesome.
Freeway Ross Douthat. No, but everything that Sean Hannity is, Ross Douthat is not. Sean Hannity is at Fox News. And
Sean Hannity is the guy who he was putting in the toilet.
No,
he's
Ross,
the dude
right, yeah.
getting the swirly.
That's absolutely correct.
Like, Sean Hannity plays to an audience of, as we've just discussed, desperate spinsters and the bewildered elderly at 10 o'clock on Fox News. Ross Douthat is, you know, ensconced within the op-ed page of the New York Times.
He's the thinking man's conservative.
And he, you know, let's be honest, he plays to an audience of people who read the New York Times, right? Like, there's not a big crossover in the Sean Hannity, Ross Douthat demographic. But like Sean, Ross has been a fascinating figure to me for a long time. And I want to do something now. I want to do sort of the Ross Douthat reading series because, like I said, Ross is an interesting character, and not a lot. A lot of people know who Ross Douthat is because they see his columns and they see him on Twitter and stuff. But a lot of people don't know sort of like how he started out in this game. And
They do wonder though when they see his picture. They think, when is he going to finish growing that goatee?
Yeah, I guess it's because like. Ross is almost my age that he kind of disgusts me more than some of these other people.
He is the youngest Times columnist. I don't know if it's the youngest columnist ever, but
he's got to be.
Yeah, I think he might be the youngest columnist they ever hired.
I mean, Ross is like, he's like 4 years older than me. So like, it's conceivable. He's 36 right now. But
by the way, I just want to interject. You can say his name however you want, but I do love that you say it Douthat, like it's like truth out. But I think just in case we want to stick to it.
I think it's
Douthat. Yes.
Yeah, I always thought it was Douthat.
Okay. Yeah. Well.
It's like, bitch, you ever gonna actually generate some testosterone? I fucking doubt that.
Well, I have to give you know, proper respect. Douthat, is that it?
Douthat.
Yeah.
Douthat. Yeah. I mean, I'm gonna have to. I believe that you should always spell and pronounce a person's name the way they prefer, right before you kick a fucking divot out of their skull, which is what I'm about to do right now. Okay. What I'm gonna do here is I'm gonna read from an excerpt from Ross's book called. This is his book called Privilege, Harvard and the Education of the Ruling Class, published by Hyperion in 2005. And this was when he was a young up-and-comer. He wrote this book that was obviously a sort of his take on William F. Buckley's famous book, God and Man, at Yale. And this was excerpted in The Atlantic under the title, We're on our way home now, Ducky, sailing, swimming, and sipping nightcaps with William F. Buckley, Jr. So this is an excerpt.
I never thought this would happen to me.
This is an excerpt from Ross Douthat's book. Again, this was published. I've known about this for a while, and I have to say it's actually one of my favorite things ever written because I think it is genuinely one of the funniest things ever put to paper.
We definitely need to do a trigger warning basically for everything. If you have any kind of squeamishness, if you have ever been triggered by anything in your life,
yeah,
do not listen.
Hit pause now.
We have all of the hits, I think, in this show, but this and one other passage from Privilege are probably only rivaled in conservative erotica by Bill O'Reilly's excruciating sex scene in his novel, Those Who Trespass. And
yeah,
I think this has the advantage of being real.
Yeah, the funny thing is that this is not thinly veiled fiction. This is just memoir. Yeah. Okay, so this is the Ross Douthat reading series. But before I start, I need to do a preface. This is a preface to the William F. Buckley story that Ross relates. But this is from the same book. I'm just going to read a scene that Ross relates here. And I want my co-hosts and everyone listening to the show to put yourself in the mind of a young Ross Douthat. You imagine that you are a 19-year-old lad full of vim and vinegar, home from college. So I'm going to start reading now. One successful foray ended on the guest bed of a high school friend's parents with a girl who resembled a chunkier Reese Witherspoon drunkenly masticating my neck and cheeks. It had taken some time to reach this point. Quote, "Do most Harvard guys take so long to get what they want?" she had asked, pushing her tongue into my mouth. I wasn't sure what to say, but then I wasn't sure what this is what I wanted. My throat was dry from too much vodka, and her breasts, spilling out of pink pajamas, threatened my ability to. I was supposed to...
Hold on a minute. What did that mean?
I don't know. I'm going on.
His ability to what?
I'm going on. I was supposed to be excited, but I was bored and somewhat disgusted with myself, with her, with the whole business. And then whatever residual enthusiasm I felt for the venture dissipated with shocking speed as she nibbled my ear and whispered, "You know, I'm on the pill." So, again, imagine that you are a 19-year-old. Imagine yourself at 19. You're alone at a friend's house. Their parents are away. You're in your friend's parents' bedroom with a girl who, quote, resembles a chunkier Reese Witherspoon. Now, a lot of people have gotten Ross a lot of stick for this because he's basically calling this girl fat for trying to have sex with him. But in my opinion, a chunkier Reese Witherspoon is like a better Reese Witherspoon.
Bear in mind that while you're doing that with the chunkier Reese Witherspoon, you look like a shriveled, bloated sack of just failed manhood.
You look like like Paul Giamatti with a neck beard.
Ross dude hat looks like the dad from Too Many Cooks if he was played by a thumb. I just got to say that shows that, like, real, authentic street soldiers like him thick. And Ross,
yeah, I like a juicy bitch. Everyone here at Chapo likes, if they're not thick, then if the spoon doesn't stand up in the oatmeal, then
yeah,
I'm saying goodbye.
Ross Dudehead has never gotten all up in them guts. Like, you can talk about God and the man at Yale or privilege at Harvard all you want, but if, like, you ain't never had her bend over and she begging for more dick and you give her that look. Like, I'm sorry.
I just want to ill-advisedly interrupt by saying that that is the quote that gets around, but Will, you've left out the line that follows that last
bit. Have?
Yeah, because no. This I take it you've got that from the internet because it's all over the internet. But I looked up the actual book. And there's one more line that I think is perfect, which is as follows. So she goes, "You know, I'm on the pill." And then it completes. "On that night, in that dank basement bedroom, she spoke for all of us, the whole young American elite. Not I love you, not this is incredible, not let's go all the way, but I am on the pill." So just giving you a little... So a little flourish there.
This is
a motherfucker would need a stepladder to get up in them guts.
This is my preface to the real goods of this story here. But just again, imagine you're 19, a juicy Reese Witherspoon whispers, basically demands that you fuck her, and what do you do? Well, obviously, you just basically throw up a little in your mouth.
What you do is you say, "I'm sorry, madam, but this endeavor has grown quite unappealing." And I say, "Good day, madam." And then you grab your walking stick and your valise, and you wrap your scarf around your neck, and you bid good day.
Or if you're feeling froggy, you like put on this Francisco Franco mask, please.
Okay, so that's the...
I love it when you call me Big Augusto.
that's the preface. That's the chunky Reese Witherspoon anecdote, which I think colors a lot of what is to come. Okay, so I'm starting now. This is from the excerpt about meeting William F. Buckley as a young man. The setup here is that him and fellow college conservative, who was his fellow intern at the National Review, on their first day on the job, get invited over to a special dinner at William F. Buckley's house. William F. Buckley, founder of the National Review, sort of godfather of the modern conservative movement. They're chosen to go see the great man at his house on the Upper East Side. So I'm not going to read all of this, but I'm going to read one paragraph here. The current editors, his chosen heirs, dined with him every second Monday, and as a special treat, I was asked to dinner on my first day. I had only just met Jamie, but we sealed our friendship that night, gawking together at Buckley's fantastic uptown lair, the gimlet-eyed butler, the cooks and maids murmuring in Spanish, the dinner
table. Fuck you, Mr. Gimlet-eyed. Fuck
the,
you.
The dinner table with glasses of cigarettes by each place setting, the luxurious sitting room with its lush tapestries and lacquered tables. So he's captured a lot of detail about what his apartment looks like and the sort of finishings and furnishings.
The eyes were gimlet as fuck.
But it goes on. We gawked, too, at Buckley himself, who swept down to greet us, his eyes bright and curious, his wit languid but mischievous, and his flesh... His flesh slacking a bit.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God. The flesh is slacking.
The flesh slacking a bit with age, but still held together by a lurking energy, a sense of coiled potency.
Oh, God. The male essence, as it were.
Okay, this is the first annotation. We said last time that you have to Google image search the people we're talking about. He's talking about William F. Buckley circa 2005.
He looked like a fucking maybe. Melting... He looked like
William
a...
William Buckley, always as a young man, looked like some kind of fucking Gila monster.
He looked like the squirrel from the Ice Age movies. The giant bug eyes.
This is how Ross is this. Look up Google image search William F. Buckley like right before he died. And he looks like the fucking Walking Dead. Like, I mean, you
cannot imagine.
It's
like the Crypt Keeper, but racist.
Yes. The night, and this is, yeah, it, or as Ross calls it, lurking potency.
Lurking potency. I believe that was the most horrifying of Lovecraft's short stories.
Yeah.
Lurking potency.
That's a great handle.
So
yes. Lurking potency.
So Ross and his new friend Jamie, they have dinner at Buckley's house, but wouldn't you know it, they're invited out to his estate in Connecticut to go sailing this Friday. Okay. Jamie and I rode the train along to the Connecticut coast, where Buckley picked us up wearing a jaunty cap and driving a Land Cruiser. We'll stop off at my house first, he told us as we pulled away from the station. We were spirited off to his summertime cottage, which waited at the end of a long gravel drive. Blah, blah, blah. Newly mown lawn, trees, inside, we were introduced to Buckley's boat boy, Ben.
Oh, Ben. Please, Ben, blink twice if you're being held against your will.
Ben, a bearded Yale student hired for the summer to help out on the sailboat. Drinks with Pat followed in a sea-facing room with deep armchairs and a huge tiger skin rug dominating the floor. While we chatted, a small dog leapt into her lap. He's new, she declared as the dog, an adorable King Charles Spaniel, nuzzled at her long fingers. His name is Sebastian, but we call him Sebby. There was general agreement on Sebby's excellence. It's like,
this is like how people... In P.G. Wodehouse stories.
Yeah, this is exactly what I mean. This is like, to me, this whole episode is like a really, really great episode of like a really funny British comedy series. Yeah.
Like, when he said we remarked on Sebby, like, general agreement on Sebby's excellence, I flashbacked. I wish that Hezbollah burst into the room. Fucking everybody and re-educated the dog.
Okay. It gets better. The boat boy awaited us on Buckley's vessel, Petito. The first large sailboat I had been on. This is a night of many new experiences for
wow.
me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Look at Katy Perry song.
Fireworks. Yeah. No, he said. He, a nod to Buckley, takes out an ad in the Yale Daily News every spring for someone to crew his boat for the summer, and I answered it. That was his first mistake. He didn't know quite, he didn't know quite as much about sailing as I'd like, Buckley confided to us a moment later as the first mate scrambled below to fix a rope. But he does as he does what he's told well enough, and he has other duties. Speaking of which, he raised his voice. How about those hors d'oeuvres, Ben? Okay. So
how fucking thick and how legally rigorous was the non-disclosure agreement that he had to sign before he took that job?
I feel like William F. Buckley could have fucked Ben the boat boy in the ass in front of Dutat. He'd be like, oh, they were reenacting the classics. Like, missing this fucking thick skull goatee motherfucker.
So basically, they actually get out on a boat with him. There's no escape at this point. So as Charlie says on It's Sunny in Philadelphia, the implication is already there.
The implication is, yeah.
So basically, Buckley gets insanely drunk and pretends to be interested in a conversation that Ross and his friend Jamie are having. Buckley seemed to be paying close attention, cocking his head to one side as we went back and forth. I mean, again, just probably bored, fucking stupid, listening to these two assholes try to impress
him. Also, that's a great verb. That's a great verb. Let's go with that word.
Yeah. Well, I said that Goku would be on the side of Neo. That's a good point about Goku, young lad.
Buckley tells him to put a sweater on. Buckley drank the most, but if it affected him, I never noticed. We talked about the Red Sox, baseball, and Ayn Rand, with Jamie asking Buckley if he had been there on the night that Ludwig von Mises famously reduced her to tears by calling her a little Jew girl.
Ah, yes. I never forget an anti-Semitic moment. I keep a small journal of every instance where a Jew is brought low, as they deserve.
Okay, here's where it gets really good. After dessert had been set aside and Ben had gone to clean up, Buckley gathered himself up from his seat and peered down at us. I generally take a swim after eating, he said. You're all welcome to swim, of course, as well. Now that he mentioned it, a swim seemed like just the thing. I imagine practically anything would have sounded just like the thing at that point in the evening. Ross has had a little too much to drink.
Yeah.
I put a Molly in her brandy and he ain't even know it.
But then I considered the matter more deeply and heaved a deep and regretful sigh. I'd swim, sir, I said. I would swim. I really would like to, but I'm afraid I didn't bring a bathing suit. Well, neither did I. After all, it's quite dark out there, and we're all men here, you see. when he was gone, Jamie and I sat for a moment in silence, the dinner settling in our stomach and the wine rising to our eyes.
Oh, my God.
You aren't actually going to go swimming, are you? He asked me. Aren't you? I demanded. Well, what? I don't really like to swim very much in general. Well, Jamie, I said grandly, neither do I, honestly. But, you know, I think there comes a time in a man's life when he has the chance to say to his grandchildren, I once went skinny dipping with William F. Buckley, and this, Jamie, is that chance. I'm not making this up. I didn't write that, by the way. I didn't write this. This was published in a book under Ross Douthat's name.
If I told, like, my younger cousins that I went skinny dipping with William F. Buckley III, what the fuck I'm talking about? It's, like, not a cool story. Unless you get to the point where you fuck Ben the Boat Boy's dick.
It goes on. Ben the Boat Boy tells him about his usual company. Ben says, he has guests on the boat almost every weekend. Usually it's old friends from Skull and Bones, ex-ambassadors, people like that. I've heard sometimes you get European nobility, deposed Romanovs, and that kind of stuff. So Buckley is going out on this boat basically every weekend and just, like, getting his dick off with, like, various...
the week before he died, Anastasio Somoza was up there. And they fucking rubbed dicks together in the Long Island Sound.
They spaceported with each other right off Oyster Bay.
Habsburg jaw actually refers to when the last of the Austrian Habsburgs unhinged his jaw and William F. Buckley just fucking smacked his uvula.
Oh, God. Like, I mean, I don't need to read anymore. It goes on. Buckley tries to give them more brandy and shit, but like, I'm just gonna, Ross really let him down, right? Because he probably.
So this
got
is like, yeah. I mean, this is what they. What do they call it in the world of childhood sexual abuse?
He's a chicken hawk. He was
yeah,
chicken
but
hawk
I mean, like, there's the term like grooming. That's it. He is grooming them, obviously. Well, and you could and they might not have worked out, but you could tell that Ross was further along than Jamie. If Buckley had like zeroed in on one of them for future grooming, it would have been Ross.
What have we learned about William F. Buckley? More of a real authentic street soldier than Ross, because he likes his bitches thick. Get me a thick one.
Oh yes, there's nothing quite so. Crumulent is a thick bitch in one's face.
Oh, give me that Harvard boy, have him bent over and looks back at me. What?
I'm tired of these Yaleys. I'm tired of these Yaleys. Invite that young Harvard lad over to dinner, and then we'll get him on the boat.
So to stay briefly with young Ross,
boss.
I also found a 2001 profile in the Harvard Crimson, because Ross actually, before landing at the National Review in the Atlantic and then landing at the New York Times in 2009 and going on to predict that Marco Rubio would win literally every single Republican primary in 2016, he was at the Crimson at Harvard, but also the right-wing campus paper, The Salient. So he was quite prolific.
Wait, I'm sorry, the right-wing paper at Harvard was called The Salient?
The Salient, yes.
Oh.
But he had a column at the Crimson, and in his senior year they did a profile of.
The Crimson is like the official Harvard newspaper, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, it has a. This is kind of the Rosetta Stone of Douthatology, and it has a lead that in my.
You mean the one I just read isn't.
I'm sorry, yeah. I don't want to start judging these things. It's a very important chapter.
It's part of the canon. It's part of the canon.
It's canon. So it has a lead, though, that completely obliterates his image as a stoic, philosophical conservative in the mold of, say, Michael Oakeshott or maybe even Buckley himself. And here it is. This is the lead. When Ross G. Douthat tells you that he hopes to become one of the world's most prominent writers, you get the sense that he just might. Quote of Ross, coming to Harvard, I now have a new sense of the power and success that is at our fingertips. I know I will be one of the 25 richest writers of the future, he says. Douthat has always stood apart from the crowd. As a sole Republican in a, quote, staunch hardline Democrat family, he formed his conservative worldview from an early age as a way of, quote, rebelling against my parents. So just kind of immediately... you do get the sense that Ross, like many a conservative pundit, their politics are sort of just fighting the battles of like college or earlier when like they wanted to differentiate themselves socially or you know they were mad at the libs at say Skidmore like Will and I went to for just making them feel unwelcome, so they just decided for the rest of their career I will be a Catholic reactionary. And that seems to be Ross's.
Correct me
line.
If I'm wrong. Before he was a Catholic reactionary, his first conversion experience was to Pentecostalism.
He grew up in what he describes as a semi-charming New Haven Pentecostal household. Okay. According to New York Magazine, his parents would sometimes speak in tongues, but eventually those tongues met the sweet cleansing taste of a communion wafer.
There is a chance that Ross. That it's all put on with him, and if so, I gotta say that the Buckley anecdote is one of the funniest things I've ever read. I mean, it's like better than Whitnail and I, in my opinion.
Yeah,
I mean, like that kind of like dry British humor.
So here's the test, really, because the last thing there's two more things, but the second last thing I'll chip in here is I looked through some of his Harvard Crimson columns back from you know the early millennium, and he used to be a lot more right wing. In college, he was basically, in fact, that profile called him Move Over Limbaugh. So he was much more in the mold of Limbaugh or Hannity, you could say, with some more intellectual underpinnings. But like he clearly, to use the word groomed again, he clearly groomed himself into more of a David Brooks type after he left Harvard. So here's a quote from one of his columns in which he compares watching porn, which the whole column is just bemoaning the fact that porn is widely available on the internet.
And he compares watching it.
Well, it's comparing watching porn to being a neo-Nazi mass murderer. And here's the quote. Everyone talks about how the boys in Columbine learned to make bombs on the internet and whiled away their unhappy hours on neo-Nazi websites. Nobody talks about the fact that the web's most profitable sites are not Yahoo, Amazon, or Priceline, but sites that peddle what in more innocent times used to be called dirty pictures. So just kind
innocent
of
innocent times. Like, how old are you? You don't remember any of that?
Oh, well, you could go down to the Nickelodeon and see a woman's ankle.
Back when
that fucker went to class with a walking stick. I will bet money that was happening.
I'm not gonna think that shit. You know, he harkens back to a more innocent time when you had to take your sailboats out in international waters for a good experience.
You know, all these websites with their crude images of naked women. Where's a shot of an 80-year-old reactionary spreading his butt cheeks in the Long Island Sound?
Wait, finish the quote about pornography, though.
Well, I mean, that's the only.
Oh, that was it.
Yeah. It was just dirty.
Like,
so
it's like everyone talks about the Columbine kids playing like Doom 2, but like they aren't talking about them trading like grainy, pixelated like topless
right.
shots in AOL
right.
chat rooms.
Right. So it was generally just kind of he was making the comparison, I guess, to just bring more of the heat onto pornography. But then there was one other. A truly bizarre column that I guess was attacking the idea that stereotypes are bad. And it appears to suggest that Asian people give Ross Douthat nightmares.
I just want to say I also agree. I don't think stereotypes are bad. They save me a lot of time thinking.
That's classic. So it's clearly written with some type of, you know, like tongue-in-cheek. He's trying to, you know, make certain people at Harvard uncomfortable, maybe. And
I find that a lot
cheeky.
Of these guys, they really try to, like, they try to be like H.L. Mencken, but it never works.
No.
Yeah.
And in this, he's basically, he's sort of trying to dance around the corners of being politically correct by zooming in on one group he says he could choose to embarrass, Harvard Asians. So he writes, if I really wanted to offend Harvard Asians, I might sit down and write an article in which I was, well, a tad critical of the Asian community. For instance, I might suggest that there was, let's say, a slight trend toward ethnic self-segregation or a slight proclivity for the sciences over the humanities among Asian Americans. And I might, if I were so inclined, not that anyone would be, get downright nasty and suggest that a large chunk of these self-segregated math and science types are self-absorbed, clannish, and downright weird. So, I just have to point
these,
out
that these celestials are such an inscrutable.
The heathen Chinese does not understand.
That is
what humans and Americans are.
Like something that Steve the Drunk would say in Deadwood. Like you could hear it. You could hear him saying like, oh, these clannish and downright weird. So like,
yes, but
when was the last time you saw a white man eating together at the dining hall?
Excuse me, but did you not notice in that he said he could write that?
That's right.
He wasn't writing it.
Good thing
he
didn't.
He could write it.
It's a great thing he didn't. And so finally, the last thing I have to contribute on Boss Ross is that of all the people that you can imagine, in the bubble that is the punditocracy, to be Douthat's best friend, and not only best friend, but best man. I was not expecting that person to be Michael Barbaro of the New York Times, but that is, in fact, his soulmate.
Now you said that Michael Barbaro of quote, "This situation has become dangerous and unacceptable fame."
As I like to call him, NPR Wolverine.
Michael Barbaro is like, he's like the Robert Fisk of subways. Like, he's seen all the most dangerous shit. He's seen the big handbags, the homeless people.
One time, the dancing kids who breakdance on the subway, one of them almost kicked him in the head.
Yeah, he still hasn't recovered from that. But no, Michael Barbaro is a reporter for the New York Times who we talked about him last week, but he really got famous because he was at the 42nd Street subway station on one of the sort of like tunnels or like underpasses in the station, and took a photo of a homeless man lying on the ground, like asleep or unconscious or something like that. You know, again, without his consent, just took a photo of a homeless man. And tweeted it at the MTA, saying, "The situation in the 41st Street underpass has become dangerous and unacceptable." And, like, that to me, like, it, you know, I take the subway every day, and, you know, there are a lot of homeless people on the subway. Sometimes, like anyone who rides the subway, you can feel maybe ill at ease if they're being very demonstrable or mentally unwell in some way. But at no point have I seen a guy just, like, unconscious on the ground and thought, you know, I'm the one that's really in danger here.
Yeah.
And just begging someone to do something about this.
For me, that is a classic moment. It's hilarious. But for me, the moment that sums up Barbaro is one sentence that he wrote in an article last year already, in April of 2015, at the very beginning of the Republic of Bush. And at this point, like, Trump wasn't in the race. It was pretty quiet. People were trying to figure things to write about, you know, because they were just following these guys as they, you know, press the flesh at, like, county fairs in Iowa and stuff. And so he wrote this article about Jeb Bush's paleo diet and how it's changed his, like, now he doesn't eat, he passes on carbs and stuff like that, and it's like, it's a nothing article, but he tries to give it a patina of meaning, you know, for like, what does this mean for his run? So he writes this sentence. Okay, so he talks about how he's been saying no to carbs at all of these different meals, you know, these dinners that he's had. And so to try to give it some sort of relevance to the campaign, Michael Barbaro wrote, "The single worst sentence I've ever read in the New York Times." And that includes all of Judith Miller's shit about the run-up to the invasion of the war in Iraq.
That killed hundreds of thousands of people.
Yes, worse than all of it. "The rigid abstemiousness runs the risk of putting him at a dietary distance from an American electorate that still binges on carbohydrates, and, after 8 years of a tea-sipping president, craves a relatable eater-in-chief."
Ooh. Oh, my God.
Ooh. That's rough.
He deserved to be assaulted by all those handbags.
He should have been given a blanket party by every crusty hobo living underneath Times Square.
So absolutely. They, by the way, they don't let him cover Kasich events because he'll get PTSD. Like, this is unacceptable.
Several men approached me with a bindle. They unfolded their bindles in front of me. There was a half-eaten can of beans inside.
The fingerless gloves. The level of fingerless gloves at this event is dangerous and unacceptable.
There was a trash fire. That wasn't up to code.
Governor Kasich, I do not care about why they wouldn't let you use the bathroom.
You buy something or get out, sir.
There was
he was rusty. This guy Michael Barbaro, who's been, you know, an object of ridicule before, he was not only was Ross Douthat's best man at Ross's wedding, he was also, like, they were high school friends too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They were best friends apparently. Keeping in mind everything we just discussed about Barbaro's interaction with a homeless man and Douthat's columns about Harvard Asians, unquote, New York Times, in a Mother Jones profile of Douthat, New York Times reporter Michael Barbara says, there is at the heart of Ross this enormous tolerance. And and he confides that he was his best man and best friend. He says, the whole point of my speech at the wedding was that two people can be as different as can be and still be friends. He is conservative. I am certainly not as conservative as he is. He is
no,
straight.
I'm a conservative is what he's saying.
Well, this is Barbaro.
Yeah, no,
saying,
I know.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. And he says, he is straight. I am not. We would get in these bruising arguments, but every year, even in college, we would go to midnight mass at St. Mary's. I think he enjoyed bringing me in there, so I would cease to be a sinner for one night every year. So that's the
what a wonderful friendship they have.
Yeah, hey, Michael, I see your sinning lifestyle. I'm also a gay man, but I only do it on boats.
I guess I shouldn't surprise me, but you know, to find out the two of these guys are that close, it's just like, what is the? It's just like 6 degrees of Kevin hate them is sort of how I feel about all this.
It like, well, there's, you know, like now we see all like the Trump people who tweet at like Michael Barbaro and shit like that, and they're like, you fucking cuck piece of shit, I'm gonna murder you. And like under normal, if they were tweeting it just like sounds like you reported it, like you didn't even notice, you'd be like, that's terrible that happens to them just because they're in the media. But now I'm like, I think they should go farther. Like, I look at like the conservative guys making fun of all these guys, I think that they should step it up.
Well, I only have just one more bit here. It is a line I completely agree with Ross Douthat about, and it's where I'll leave it as far as he's concerned. It's from the profile. Ross's room is adorned with posters of Audrey Hepburn and Marilyn Monroe, as well as a towering tribute to Gladiator, the movie Gladiator starring Russell Crowe. He's obsessed with this movie. It comes up a lot. He tweets about it a lot. Quote from Ross, I think that Russell Crowe's evocation of manhood is something all men should aspire to, particularly when there are such obvious parallels between Rome and the United States with the combination of splendor and decadence of empire. I actually totally agree with that.
Ross's college dorm room was adorned with posters of classic sort of like female icons of the golden age of Hollywood and Gladiator, right?
Yes.
We're not wrong. I did just hear that, right?
Yes.
Okay. We'll move on.
Ross Dude Hat is Ralph Cifaretto from The Sopranos. Like, most neutered version. Tony, she was trying to kiss me and told me she was on the pill. Beats the woman to death because she pulls out a diaphragm.
She was a whore, Tony. A whore.
There's
Tony,
actually
no values left at the Bing or Harvard.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Actually, just as an Easter egg, the one character on The Sopranos that you cannot not see Ross Douthat looking like is the Russian guy who Tony kills the friend of. He looks exactly like Ross Douthat.
Valerie,
yeah. And Ross Douthat also looks like, as we pointed out earlier, the serial killer in Too Many Cooks. And if anyone's ever seen Dr. Zhivago, he looks exactly like Rod Steiger's character, who's this aristocrat who rapes a princess.
She wasn't on the pill though, so he was like.
I'm not connecting that to Douthat's personality whatsoever.
We are not saying Ross Douthat is a rapist.
I'm just saying that Rod Steiger as the Russian aristocrat looks exactly like Ross Douthat in that movie.
Well, okay. I think we've put both Sean Hannity and Ross Douthat into bed, and we've tucked them in. I think that about does it for episode 3 of the Chapo Trap House. But before I go, I said I have to give a shout out. You know, we ended last week's show threatening to kill Ben Dreyfuss and then extorting money from him. So I worried that was a little too mean. So I want to put on drop my sneer for a second and give a sincere shout out to Brett and Brian from Street Fight. If it wasn't for them and Street Fight, basically the Trap House would not be here today. These guys, they gave us the blueprint. They had all of us on.
The originators.
Yeah. We wouldn't be doing the Trap House if it wasn't for Street Fight. So thanks to Brett and Brian, and we are definitely going to have them on, one or both of them on sometime soon, to pay it forward. They invited us into their home, and now we're inviting them into our trap home. All right, is that it, guys? Yeah. Anything else you want to say?
Not me.
No.
Okay.
Just that Ross Douthat should be on a watch list, obviously.
Michael Barbaro, you have T-minus 1 week to donate to the podcast, or I will find the exact fucking 3 train that you take and spill candies all over the floor. I'll take out my gym bag. I'll hit you in your glasses with it. I'm going to tape your asshole shut, pour Monster Energy drink down your mouth. This is a new character I'm doing. The ironic death threat guy.
Yeah,
Barbara, I'm gonna take you to Golden Corral, and I'm gonna fucking stick your head under the chocolate Wonderfall until you get diabetes.
Barbara, I'm gonna find you wandering around Times Square, frightened. I'm gonna take one of those novelty-sized gummy worms that are like ludicrously large and beat you with it. I'm going to whip you with a novelty gummy worm and then make you eat the whole fucking thing.
He's on blast.
I hope you enjoyed these parodies that were in no way sincere.
For entertainment purposes only.
Yeah, these characters we're playing, as I said before. The character is that we're dangerously unhinged and have a poisonous vendetta against D-list media figures. That's the character we're portraying on this podcast. So I'm going to drop the character and
it's
just
a fun make 'em up.
I'm just going to say peace to the Chapo Nation, and we will see you guys next week.
So I'd like to see a cute couple come up. How long have you been dating? 3, 4, 5 years. Okay, why didn't you ask her? And I start putting, I put him on the... under the
you gun. Go around the country asking men to propose to their girlfriends.
And I said, well, you're never going to do better. I said, why don't you do it now? Don't you think you should do it now? And the crowd gets in, and I have a success rate of about 90%.
How do you know that later they've gotten married?
I don't, but I mean, it doesn't
matter.
What do
you mean? But the success rate implies that they went and got married.
In other words, he gets on his knee and proposes.
Oh, wow, so you follow through that moment.
Oh, yeah.